Hello and welcome to Crime Monthly presents Evil Uncovered, where each week we take you inside some of the most shocking crimes ever committed. In this episode, we follow the disturbing paths of three prolific predators whose crimes went unchallenged for far too long. For decades, these men quietly moved around their neighborhoods and communities, proving that sometimes evil really can hide in plain sight. Listener discretion is advised. Our first story takes us deep into the Alaskan wilderness, where a terrifying string of murders unfolded between 1971 and 1983. Over 12 years, young women disappeared from Anchorage at an alarming rate, leaving the community gripped by fear as a ruthless predator stalked the city's icy streets. In the quiet neighborhood of Muldoon, few suspected that the friendly local baker, known for handing out free pastries and supporting those in need, was hiding a dark secret. Behind his charming exterior, he was a sadistic killer who abducted women, flew them into the remote wilderness, and hunted them for sport. And the butcher baker might have continued his brutal spree if not for the escape of one intended victim, whose courage finally unmasked the monster lurking in their midst. Seventeen-year-old sex worker Cindy Paulson was working the streets of Anchorage on June the 13th, 1983, when she was approached by a man in a car. He offered her $200 for sex, but as an unsuspecting Cindy got into the vehicle, the man pulled a gun on her. Officers would later say,
"After Cindy was abducted, the assailant drove her to his home in the Muldoon area. There, she was chained by her neck to a post in the basement and subjected to horrific abuse. When he was done, he put her back in his car and drove to a nearby airfield, saying he was taking her to his cabin. He was going on a hunt, and she was about to become the prey."
Cindy knew she would have no chance of survival if her kidnapper got her onto that plane. So, while he went to prepare the two-seater aircraft, she threw herself out of the car. Barefoot, and with her hands cuffed in front of her, she took off running towards a nearby road and was able to flag down a passing truck. At her request, the driver took Cindy to a motel to call her boyfriend.
"It was that truck driver who came in to report what had happened. Our officers found Cindy at the motel and took her back to the station. There, she was able to describe her assailant and give detailed information about his home and his car.
He had glasses, a stutter. He seemed so normal. But what he did to me was depraved. It was beyond human."
What none of us realized at that point was that the young lady had just escaped the man who'd been terrorizing Anchorage for over a decade, committing the worst crimes in our state's history.
Cindy's clear and precise account of her kidnapper, his home and his car, led officers to the residence of Robert Hansen, a mild-mannered local baker. Hansen was taken into custody, but he denied Cindy's accusations, claiming she was trying to extort money from him after he'd picked her up for sex. A friend provided him with an alibi, and he was released without charge. Cindy's statements would later play a crucial role in bringing Hansen's murderous spree to an end. But first, where did it all begin? Hansen was born on February the 15th, 1939, in the quiet town of Estherville, Iowa. His early years were marked by profound loneliness, exacerbated by a painful stutter and severe acne that left him scarred both physically and emotionally. These made him a target for ridicule, pushing him further into isolation.
Spit it out! Spit it out!
At home, his father Christian was a stern and demanding man, running the local bakery with an iron fist. He would often say to his son,
"You need to toughen up, Robert. The world isn't kind to the weak."
These words only deepened Robert's sense of isolation. He was expected to follow in his father's footsteps, but the young boy found no joy in the bakery's confines. Instead, he sought solace in the vast Iowan wilderness, where he could escape the harsh realities of his life. Yet as he grew older, a dark hatred for women began to fester, fueled by feelings of rejection and humiliation, particularly by the girls who ignored him. Hunting animals became more than just a pastime for Hansen. It was an outlet for his growing anger and frustration. He honed his skills with a rifle and a bow, becoming an expert marksman. In the wilderness, he found a sense of control that eluded him in other aspects of his life. This control over life and death was a dark precursor to the horrors he would later inflict on human lives. In 1957, Hansen enlisted in the US Army Reserve and, after a year, transitioned to a role that seemed to suit his disciplined nature. He became a police academy drill sergeant in Pocahontas, Iowa. It was during this period that Hansen met his first wife. They married in the summer of 1960, and for a brief moment it seemed Hansen might lead a conventional life. However, the pretense of normalcy was shattered when his darker inclinations surfaced. That year, he was arrested for setting fire to a school bus garage, an act of revenge for what he perceived as mistreatment during his high school years. Hansen served 20 months behind bars and, during his incarceration, underwent a psychiatric evaluation that revealed troubling traits.
Robert Hansen was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and described as having an infantile personality, characterized by a childlike fixation on revenge. In essence, he exhibited a disturbing obsession with getting back at those he felt had wronged him, and his behavior was indicative of a deep-seated need for retribution.
The strain of Hansen's arrest and imprisonment took a toll on his marriage, and his wife filed for divorce. In 1963, Hansen married his second wife, Darla. A woman of deep faith, Darla believed her love and the power of religion could help Hansen overcome his troubled past. 4 years later, the couple sought a fresh start in Anchorage, Alaska. The move was meant to be a new beginning, a chance to leave behind the shadows of Hansen's previous life, and for a little while, it seemed to work. He quickly established himself as a respected member of the community by opening a bakery. Known for his friendly demeanor, he became a well-liked figure in the neighborhood, and the couple soon settled into their new life, even welcoming two children, which further solidified their place in the community. Neighbors would say,
"Bob was just a regular guy. He ran a successful bakery, and everyone in the community liked him. There was absolutely nothing to suggest anything was wrong in that house."
But beneath the surface of this seemingly perfect life, Hansen's dark side was simmering. On December the 1st, 1971, he was arrested for attempting to kidnap a housewife from her apartment at gunpoint. The community was shocked, and shortly after, Hansen was also charged with raping a sex worker. As part of a plea bargain, Hansen received 5 years for assault with a deadly weapon against the housewife, while the charge for the attack on the sex worker was dropped. Hansen was released just 6 months into his sentence and placed into a work release program. 5 years later, he was arrested for the theft of a chainsaw from a department store. Once again, he was set free just months into his sentence. Hansen's escalating behavior should have been a red flag for law enforcement, but he continued to fly under the radar.
Hansen's early release and the leniency he received were critical mistakes. His behavior was escalating, and it was only a matter of time before he committed more serious crimes.
That warning would become chillingly true by 1972, when the city of Anchorage came under the shadow of a vicious predator. Hansen's targets were often sex workers, women he believed would not be missed, and he would abduct them at gunpoint before flying them to his remote cabin in the Matsu Valley. A stunning wilderness filled with mountains, rivers, and glaciers, Hansen would bring true horror to the area. In his cabin, he would subject his victims to unspeakable acts of rape and torture before releasing them into the wilds. For a brief moment, they might have thought he was letting them go, that they had a chance at living through their ordeal. But the release was just another part of Hansen's sadistic games, because now the expert hunter would use his skills to track and kill the women. One of his first victims was 18-year-old Celia Van Zanten, who was abducted on December the 22nd, 1971. She did manage to escape Hansen's clutches, but the harsh Alaskan winter proved just as deadly.
"We found Celia's body on Christmas Day. It was a tragic scene. She had escaped a predator only to freeze to death, the harsh Alaskan wilderness claiming her life instead.
Celia was not alone in her fate, and over the next few years, several more bodies were found in the Seward area. But police were unable to connect the dots that pointed to a single monstrous predator.
We found bodies, but we couldn't see the pattern. It was like whoever was doing it was a ghost, and we had no way of finding him.
And so, Hansen's killing spree continued unchecked, each murder more brazen than the last. That remote wilderness became a graveyard for his victims, their final moments filled with terror and despair. It wasn't until 1983 and the escape of Cindy Paulson that the tide finally turned. Though Hansen had been released after his arrest, he remained on the police radar, and when a psychological profile developed by FBI agent John Douglas pointed squarely at Hansen, authorities secured a search warrant for his property.
Inside, we found a trove of chilling evidence, including firearms, items belonging to missing women, and a map marked with locations that would later be revealed as the grave sites of his victims.
Faced with the undeniable proof of his crimes, Hansen finally confessed, saying coldly,
"I did it. I killed them."
On February the 22nd, 1984, he agreed to a deal. In return for the death penalty being taken off the table, he pleaded guilty to 4 murders and multiple counts of rape and kidnapping. He also provided the locations of his victims' bodies, helping authorities recover those who were still missing.
In all, Robert Hansen is believed to have killed at least 17 women and assaulted at least 30, although the exact number could be higher. We will never know for sure how many women suffered at his hands.
Hansen was sentenced to 461 years in prison, without the possibility of parole. He died behind bars on August the 21st, 2014, at the age of 75. His death marked the end of one of Alaska's most notorious cases. But the impact of his crimes continues to resonate with the victims' families and the entire Alaskan community to this day. For our second story, we cross from the frozen wilderness of Alaska to the serene, snow-dusted suburbs of Great Falls, Montana, and a series of crimes involving another seemingly respectable member of the community. It was a cold February morning in 1996 when 10-year-old Zach Ramsey stepped out of his home to make the short walk to school, a journey he'd made countless times before. But that day, Zach never arrived. His sudden disappearance sent shockwaves through the neighborhood and sparked an intense police investigation. But the officers looking for the missing boy had no idea their search would lead them down a dark and twisted path, straight to the doorstep of one of the most monstrous child killers they would ever encounter. When Zach went missing, eyewitnesses remembered seeing him very near to his school.
"I saw Zach that morning, walking down the alley by his school, just like always. But there was also an obese man lurking around dressed like a police officer. It seemed odd, but I guess I didn't think much of it at the time."
Zach's case landed with Detective Bill Belushi, and he and his team searched countless local parks, rivers, and playgrounds, but there was no sign. One man came forward to confess to abducting, raping, and murdering the boy, but the police were quickly able to establish he was a fantasist who'd been nowhere near the scene of the crime. Then, Belushi's attention fell on a local man named Nathaniel Barjona. He was well known in the neighborhood for collecting toys and enjoyed having sales in his front yard that were attended by the local kids. One neighbor later told reporters,
"He was just someone who was always there, you know? I mean, I used to say hello to him when I passed by his house, but I didn't think about him one way or the other."
Barjona, who worked as a short-order cook, frequently hosted neighborhood barbecues, serving homemade burgers, chilies, and stews, which he claimed were made with deer meat. One neighbor described the taste as off and repulsive, but no one could have imagined the horrifying truth of what was actually being served. And the most devastating part of what would soon unfold is the knowledge that it could all have been prevented, because Barjona had a long history of deviant criminal behavior. Born David Paul Brown in February 1957, Barjona's story begins in the suburbs of Massachusetts. His dark tendencies surfaced at around 7 years old when he received a Ouija board for his birthday. Eager to share his new toy, he invited a five-year-old neighbor into the basement of his home. But in that dark place, Barjona's true nature revealed itself when, without warning, he began to strangle the young girl. Her screams echoed up from that underground room, reaching the ears of Barjona's mother upstairs. She rushed down, horrified by the scene unfolding before her eyes. The girl was saved, but despite the severity of his actions, his mother, perhaps in denial or simply overwhelmed, chose not to seek help. Then, at the age of 12, Barjona committed another heinous act that would foreshadow the dark path he was destined to follow. It was a cold winter's day when he lured a six-year-old boy away from his home with the innocent promise of sledding. The boy, excited by the prospect, followed Barjona without hesitation. But instead of a fun-filled day in the snow, the child was subjected to a brutal sexual assault. 3 years later, a now 15-year-old Barjona encountered two young boys riding their bikes and tried to lure them into a cemetery. He'd planned to commit his first murder, but fate intervened when one of the boys sensed something was terribly wrong.
I remember feeling this intense fear that came out of nowhere. Something about that kid just didn't seem right. Me and my friend pedaled away as fast as we could, and we know we narrowly escaped what could have been a fatal encounter.
By the time Nathaniel Barjona was 17, his violent tendencies were escalating to terrifying levels. In a chilling display of his growing boldness, he donned a police officer's uniform, a disturbing tactic that would become his trademark, and lured 8-year-old Richard O'Connor into his car. Thankfully, a vigilant neighbor witnessed the abduction and alerted the authorities. When police found the car, they discovered Richard inside. He had been beaten, assaulted, and almost strangled to death. Incredibly, despite the severity of his crimes, Barjona was given only 1 year's probation. Not long after that was up, he struck again. Disguised once more as a police officer, Barjona abducted and assaulted 9-year-old Mary Patrone. During the attack, Mary suffered a seizure, which likely saved her life as, in a panic, Barjona threw her from the car and fled the scene. A witness managed to catch his registration number, leading to his arrest. However, the details of the attack were not communicated to his probation officer, and inexplicably, Barjona was never charged.
It's hard to comprehend how someone with such a clear pattern of violence was allowed to slip through the cracks. The system failed these children and allowed that man to continue his predatory behavior.
In 1977, the streets outside a local cinema became the stage for Barjona's next crime. This time masquerading as an FBI agent, he lured two young boys into his car. What followed was a harrowing ordeal as Barjona drove them to a secluded area where he molested and strangled them. The weight of his 20-stone frame crushed one boy, and Barjona left him for dead. But the boy survived and provided a description that led to the predator's arrest.
This time, the evidence was damning as the second boy was found tied up in the trunk of Barjona's car. The justice system finally took a firmer stance, and Barjona was sentenced to between 18 and 20 years for attempted murder.
It seemed like the nightmare was over, but the darkness was far from dispelled. In 1979, 2 years into his sentence, Barjona's confessions to the prison psychiatrist led to his transfer to a psychiatric hospital. The severity of his fantasies just too great to ignore.
During our sessions, Barjona spoke of fantasies that were literally beyond all comprehension. Child rape, murder, cannibalism. It was clear this man was an extreme danger to society.
For the next 12 years, Barjona remained under constant observation. But in 1991, a shocking court ruling changed everything.
The court decided the state had not met the burden of proof to declare Barjona dangerous. So, despite his confessions and the heinous nature of his crimes, he was released. The world outside had no idea of the terror that was about to be unleashed.
After his release, it wasn't long before his urges resurfaced. He attacked a 7-year-old child in Massachusetts which led to yet more probation and a forced relocation to Montana. The authorities hoped a change of scenery might curb his predatory behavior, but they were gravely mistaken. It was Bar Jonah, dressed in his fake police uniform, that witnesses had seen with Zach Ramsey. However, reports of his past crimes had never reached Montana, leaving authorities in the dark about the sexual sadist now living among them. As the days turned into weeks, the hope of finding Zach alive began to fade, and the community of Great Falls was left grappling with fear and uncertainty. It wasn't until 1999 that things began to unravel. Bar Jonah was once again spotted loitering outside a school, and it was the dogged detective Bill Belushi who attended the scene.
I saw this man, dressed like a policeman and carrying a stun gun, and instinctively knew he was on the hunt for a victim. I pushed hard to get him arrested for impersonating an officer and, with Bar Jonah sitting in an interview room, I got a warrant to search his home for items relating to the charge. I took a team over there, and we were walking straight into a house of horrors.
Bar Jonah's apartment was a mess, but officers were able to locate several items of clothing that proved he'd been impersonating law enforcement. They also found a disturbing photo album, filled with images of naked children. Belushi was certain Bar Jonah was a predatory paedophile and applied for a wider search warrant, which was granted. When the team returned to the house, they found exactly what they were looking for. News reports would later detail their horrific findings.
In local news, and Great Falls officers have discovered tens of thousands of photos of children from the local area in the home of a suspected serial offender. Detectives confirmed the images had been cut from local newspapers, yearbooks, and newsletters, along with photos of naked children thought to have been taken by the suspect while babysitting.
And there was something else, Detective Belushi said.
We found a series of newspaper cuttings detailing the search for Zach Ramsey, whose disappearance I had been investigating for a long time, alongside a set of coded writings and a list of 22 names. We later determined that a dozen or so of the children listed were from the Great Falls area. Officers also found a hook and pulley system in the ceiling that we believe was used for asphyxiation, a wooden board with knife marks, and a fragment of human bone.
Bar Jonah was charged with abduction and assault, and the arresting officers enlisted the help of the FBI to help crack the codes in his notebooks. But what they discovered horrified everyone. Bar Jonah had detailed the abduction, torture, and murder of dozens of boys, alongside recipes he had devised, with names such as My Little Kid Dessert and Little Boy Pot Pie. It was these dishes he had allegedly been serving at his neighborhood cookouts. A meat grinder at the house had human hair in it, and a further 21 human bone fragments were found at Bar Jonah's property.
We had to face the reality that we were dealing with a predator, unlike any we had ever encountered. The evidence was overwhelming, and the horror was unimaginable.
The trial of Nathaniel Bar Jonah painted a horrifying picture of his predatory behavior. Witness after witness took the stand, each recounting their harrowing encounters with the man. Parents spoke of their children's nightmares, their lives forever scarred by his monstrous acts. One by one, they described someone who had brought terror into their lives.
He was always there in the neighborhood, just lurking. We never knew when he would strike next.
The prosecution presented damning evidence linking Bar Jonah to the disappearance of Zach Ramsey. Zach's distinctive clothes were found in Bar Jonah's home, and a note in his handwriting chillingly stated, "Zach Ramsey died." Despite this, Zach's mother refused to accept her son's death, clinging to the hope he was still alive somewhere, and the murder charge was dropped. Zach has never been seen again, nor his body found. On December the 13th, 1999, Bar Jonah was convicted of the kidnapping, aggravated assault and sexual assault of three boys, although he is suspected of being a serial rapist, child murderer and cannibal. He was sentenced to 130 years behind bars, without the possibility of parole. In April 2008, he was found dead in his cell at Montana State Prison. Weighing over 21 stone, he died of a heart attack, aged 51. As we close this truly shocking chapter, we are left to remember Zach Ramsey and all the other victims of Bar Jonah who never received justice. as well as remaining thankful for the resilience of those in law enforcement who fought to put a true monster behind bars.
Crime Monthly magazine is dedicated to all things true crime, where you'll find all the latest news, in-depth features, interviews with leading experts, and so much more. We've even got your essential entertainment guide for the month ahead. Buy in all good shops and supermarkets or subscribe now at greatmagazines.co.uk.
Our final story takes us from those snow-covered streets of Montana to the chaos of New York's Times Square in the late 1970s. A far cry from the tourist haven we know it as today, back then, it was the centre of the porn industry, with peep shows and sex clubs on every corner, and streets teeming with hustlers, pimps and sex workers. It was a breeding ground for predators. And among them was a man whose appetite for murder knew no bounds. On December the 2nd, 1979, a maid at the Travel Inn Motor Hotel noticed smoke coming from one of the rooms. Firefighters were called, and when they broke in, they were met with a horrifying sight. The bodies of two women lay on the twin beds, their heads and hands removed. The maid told investigators that a man named Carl Wilson had checked in 3 days earlier, but had kept the Do Not Disturb sign on the door. And there was no useful forensic evidence either. The scene was meticulously clean, and the killer had even folded his victim's clothes and placed them neatly in the bathtub. It was as if the police were chasing a phantom. Then, in what seemed like their first big break, a woman who'd been standing behind Wilson when he checked in came forward to provide a description.
I got a pretty good look at him, enough to say that he was a white male, around 35 years old, weighing 175 pounds with brown hair. Although I guess there are plenty of those in this town.
A composite sketch was distributed but yielded no results. Fear rippled through the community as detectives scrambled for leads, knowing that with each passing hour, the shadowy figure could strike again. When the post-mortem was conducted, the medical examiner would document findings that would haunt investigators, painting a grim picture of the brutality inflicted upon the victims.
The killer used clean cuts to remove the heads and hands of his victims, indicating a level of confidence and skill, and I would describe the injuries as sadistic, with clear signs of a struggle. The women were bound face down, assaulted, and had elongated knife wounds. They also died at different times, suggesting one was forced to watch the other die over a span of 3 days. In my opinion, the police are dealing with a sexual sadist of the most terrifying kind.
The police were no closer to finding the elusive Carl Wilson, and every day he remained at large, the danger to women across the city grew. It was just a matter of time before he struck again. On May the 15th, 1980, the Seville Hotel, just east of Times Square, became the scene of another gruesome discovery. Firefighters responding to reports of smoke billowing from one of the rooms found the mutilated body of 25-year-old Jean Rayner. She had been beaten, tortured, assaulted, and strangled. In a grim twist, both her breasts had been removed and placed on the headboard of the bed. But once again, the crime scene would yield no forensic evidence that could help track this terrifying killer, police would later say.
It was clear we were dealing with a sadistic killer. The level of violence and the way the scene was staged indicated a deeply disturbed individual.
Mother of one Jean had turned to sex work to finance a child custody lawsuit and was well known to the police, having been arrested just 2 weeks earlier. Investigators were now certain they were dealing with a serial offender the media had dubbed the torso killer, but their attempts to persuade other sex workers to come forward with information were unsuccessful. The investigation was floundering, but then an officer on the task force uncovered two earlier cases with striking similarities to the recent crimes.
We found cases involving the violent abuse of sex workers and the theft of jewelry, which we believed were taken as trophies. The man responsible was an average Joe by the name of Richard Cottingham.
Richard Cottingham seemed like any other suburbanite. He lived in New Jersey with his wife Janet and their three children, and by day, he worked as a computer programmer for a health insurance company in Midtown Manhattan. Neighbors would say,
"He was just a regular guy, you know? Always polite, always on time. You'd never suspect there was a thing about him that was dangerous."
But beneath this veneer lay a dark and twisted reality. In 1973 and 1974, Cottingham had twice been charged with the unlawful imprisonment and abuse of sex workers. Both cases were dismissed when the witnesses failed to appear in court, and Cottingham returned to his seemingly average life. But his dark urges continued to fester until that arrest by the Torso Killer Task Force. Cottingham would prove to be defiant and manipulative in interview, his earlier escapes making him feel untouchable.
"Those charges in 73 and 74? I told you back then, those girls were lying, making things up to get attention or money. And guess what? The cases were dropped. Why? Because they didn't show up. That's not on me. I've been through this before, dragged in, questioned, all because you people can't find your real suspect. And now you're desperate. The Torso Killer, that's not me."
And Cottingham was to have another lucky escape. He was ruled out as a suspect, as he didn't fit the criminal profile that had been constructed of the killer. The police were back to square one, and there was another problem. With no central files, links between crimes were often missed. As a result, New York investigators were unaware that at the same time they were searching for the Torso Killer, someone was terrorizing neighborhoods just across the river in New Jersey.
Room service. Anybody in?
On May the 5th, 1980, in the Quality Inn in New Jersey, a maid discovered the body of 19-year-old Valerie Ann Street naked under a bed. She had been strangled, her hands cuffed behind her back, and there were traces of adhesive on her mouth as well as cuts on her breasts. Police would later say,
"The killer had left a damn good latent print on the handcuff, but we were unable to get a match from our local records."
However, detectives did recall a decades-old crime that bore a striking resemblance to Valerie's murder. In 1977, 26-year-old nurse Mary Ann Carr was found in the parking lot of the Quality Inn. She had traces of adhesive on her mouth, and her ankles and wrists were cuffed. She had also been strangled. The similarities provided detectives with a vital lead connecting the cases, suggesting a serial offender with a distinctive and brutal modus operandi. Unaware the police were edging closer, Cottingham was maintaining his thin veneer of normality while indulging in ever darker pursuits. He frequented various venues in New York City's underground scene, including places like the Hellfire Club, which was known for its live master and slave acts and other extreme sexual performances. When Cottingham's wife discovered his double life, she filed for divorce, blaming his increasingly erratic behavior, infidelity, and troubling secrets. But it wouldn't be long now before Cottingham would be unmasked. On May the 22nd, 1980, he picked up runaway Leslie Ann O'Dell. He took her to a bar where Leslie confided that she wanted to escape her pimp, and when Cottingham offered to help her start a new life, Leslie got into his car. They drove to New Jersey, where Leslie agreed to accompany Cottingham to the Quality Inn. However, once inside, he launched his attack, handcuffing her, and then beating, torturing, and assaulting her for hours. Finally, he removed the handcuffs and pointed a gun at her. She would later say,
"I thought that was it for me, but I had to at least try and do something. I grabbed the gun and pointed it at him, but that's when I realized it wasn't even loaded. He lunged at me with a knife and I screamed."
Leslie's screams attracted the attention of a maid who came to the door. Realizing he was in serious danger of being caught, Cottingham attempted to flee, only to be met in the hallway by a police officer holding a gun. Cottingham was subdued, and when officers found a kit containing tape, restraints, sedatives, and handcuffs, he was arrested. The Torso Killer's time at large was up, and a media frenzy quickly followed.
"We can confirm that the man we have in our custody is the monster responsible for the murders of at least two women in New Jersey. We've also been in touch with our colleagues in New York who want to question the suspect over murders in their jurisdiction.
To charge and convict Cottingham, investigators needed survivors who could place him in both New York and New Jersey. And with the disclosure of new information by the media, more victims began to emerge. Cottingham was placed in a police lineup and positively identified by three women he'd raped, beaten, and left for dead. It was exactly the break the case needed.
We immediately issued a search warrant for his home in New Jersey and discovered a private, locked room in the basement. Inside, we found pornographic artwork, tapes, and books. But crucially, there was also a vault filled with women's clothes, purses, jewelry, and other personal belongings. Among the items were the keys to Marianne Carr's apartment and a necklace belonging to Jean Rayner.
Cottingham was charged with murders in both states and was set to be tried separately. During his first trial in New Jersey, he insisted on taking the stand and proceeded to make sensational claims that he'd been framed.
This investigation is full of corruption. Evidence was planted and facts were twisted to pin these crimes on me. I have timesheets proving I was at work when these murders happened. But the police wanted a conviction, not the truth. I'm being framed to cover up their failures. I was targeted because they needed someone to blame. I am innocent, a victim of a corrupt system.
But prosecutors argued that despite the varied methods, each crime bore Cottingham's chilling signature, handcuffing and brutal mutilation. And his alibi fell apart when a co-worker demonstrated how easily he could manipulate timesheets by tampering with the computer's clock. In early 1982, Cottingham was convicted on multiple charges, including kidnap, sexual assault, and murder, earning him multiple life sentences. This was just the start of his legal battles, as more evidence linked him to additional killings. In later years, Cottingham began confessing to even more murders, including cold cases that had baffled investigators for decades, cementing his place among the most notorious serial killers of his time. As one retired investigator put it,
all of Richard's victims were beautiful girls and women with their whole lives ahead of them. I think the common denominator for him was he looked for easy targets. In the case of the many confessions I got, these were teenage girls. They were either hitchhiking or walking home from school or work. In the later years, he graduated to picking on sex workers and runaways.
Now aged 77, Richard Cottingham is believed to have murdered dozens of women, with some estimates suggesting his true victim count could exceed 100. He remains incarcerated in New Jersey, serving multiple life sentences without the possibility of parole. In declining health, he has continued to confess to additional crimes in recent years, providing crucial details that have helped solve cold cases and bring some measure of closure to the victims' families. Authorities hope that he will reveal more information before his time runs out. All three perpetrators in this episode remind us that evil can walk among us, blending into the everyday while committing unimaginable acts. Their stories serve as a stark reminder that beneath the surface of ordinary life can lie a darkness that, thankfully, few ever see. That's all from this week's episode. Thank you for joining us and be sure to tune in next time when we'll be bringing you three more tales of true life terror. Evil Uncovered is brought to you by Bauer Media. Concept and original stories by Steph Seelan and Lisa Howells. Episode written and exec produced by Lisa Howells. Produced and edited by Rick Simmons. AI voices produced and edited by Waldemar Matwash. Episode created with support from WeDaVinci AI Technology.